Hi everyone, and welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. This is podcast number 26, and it concerns itself with the year AD 60. The title is Gutless Emperor, Warrior Queen. Okay, it's now the year AD 60, and although the dust has settled somewhat over the death of Agrippina, there's still a bad taste left in the mouths of many Romans. Seneca's smokescreen of trying to blame the former empress by accusing her of a failed assassination attempt on her son has not really been swallowed by the people, but as yet, nobody, with the sole exception of a few brave hearts like the senator Thrasypius, has had the courage to openly show they were not misled by Seneca's diversionary tactics. So, faced with no overt criticism, Nero has felt emboldened to tighten his stranglehold of terror on Rome's upper classes, executing some and forcing others to take part in displays designed to glorify and amplify his own self-proclaimed musical talents. And as for Seneca, well, he could probably see the writing on the wall. All of his attempts to make a decent ruler out of his charge Nero had come to nothing. If anything, the opposite was true, and the young emperor was rapidly careening more and more out of control. AD 60, though, would prove to be a year where events abroad, especially in the fledgling province of Britannia, were to shake Nero's growing sense of untouchability and temporarily take the wind out of his arrogant sails. We'll come back to what was happening on the domestic front in Rome later in this podcast, but first, let's shift our focus to events in the wider empire. In the eastern part of the empire, the redoubtable general Gnaeus Domitius Corbulo was continuing to have military success in Armenia. But in the west, it was a different story, as, under the leadership of the formidable warrior queen Boudica, the province of Britannia erupted into open revolt against its Roman occupiers. The catalysts for the rebellion are well documented, although we have to be a touch careful when reading the accounts of those commentators writing a generation or two after the events under different Roman imperial dynasties, as it was in their own interests to discredit the Julio-Claudians, and Nero especially as the last in a line of inept rulers, any way they could in order to legitimise the emperors under whose patronage those later commentators were writing. The chain of events that led to the violent uprising seemed to be straightforward enough. When Claudius had first invaded the island of Britannia in AD 43, he'd smoothed the way by giving vast sums of money to British colluders and allies. Now, this was common practice, as was the flood of Roman investment once the territory was conquered and integrated into the wider Roman system. The island contained prized natural resources, among them lead, tin, salt and copper, not to mention lesser quantities of silver and gold, all of which were in high demand in the empire as a whole. But there was also profit to be made from the time-honored practice of money lending, often at extortionately high interest rates, as British chieftains sought to outdo each other in prestige and take advantage of the new order. Now, it must have been a time of torn loyalties. On the one hand, the British were no longer outright rulers of the lands that the Roman armies and government officials now occupied. But on the other hand, there was growing stability and order, and the wholesale introduction of luxuries and exotic goods seldom seen in those islands before. It was into that climate of initial growth and economic expansion that Seneca had chosen to invest a lot of money. According to the ancient sources, the amount was 40 million sesterces, that's 40 million sesterces, a sum that he hoped would be returned with substantial interest. And although it's difficult to quantify in today's terms, 40 million sesterces would be somewhere around the equivalent of $55 million US dollars. In any event, it was alone which, in or around AD 60, Seneca suddenly decided to call back in, and, according to the commentators, he went about extracting it from his debtors by resorting to severe measures. The interesting thing is that around the same time, the procurator of Britannia, Decianus Catus, was also demanding that the original loans made by Claudius to his British allies be repaid, no doubt with interest. This particular Roman official's ineptitude, rapacity, and unpopularity are well documented by several of the ancient commentators. But if we put his activities alongside those of Seneca, and probably other investors in the province as well, what we have here is a period of Romans cashing in on their investment and seeking to retrieve what they felt was due to them. And they were going about it by employing pretty aggressive tactics. And that attitude, of course, was bound to breed insecurity and resentment. It was all getting very edgy in the Roman province at the edge of the known world. The place was becoming a tinderbox of bitterness and anger directed against the foreign invader. Britannia was rife for rebellion. And, sure enough, rebellion came. The actual catalyst for the uprising was the death of Prasutagus, chieftain of the Iceni, a tribe which occupied the territory around modern-day Norfolk in England and an ally of Rome. According to the Roman sources, Prasutagus had agreed that upon his death, half of his territory would go to the Roman state and the other half to his own descendants. But, under the orders of Cato Decianus, the Romans moved in quickly and took the lot. During the takeover, Prasutagus's wife Boudica was flogged and forced to look on while her daughters were raped. And that was a step too far. The Iceni and their neighbouring tribes rose up in bloody revolt. The towns of Camulodunum, modern Colchester, Londinium, London, and Verulamium, St. Albans, were sacked and their citizens slaughtered, before the warrior queen and her army were eventually outmanoeuvred and defeated by the governor himself of Roman Britain, Gaius Suetonius Paulinus. The revolt was quashed and Boudica disappeared from history. If you're interested in the details, as they've come down to us, that is, then fuller accounts of the Boudican rebellion can be found in various ancient sources, in Tacitus, Cassius Dio, and Suetonius, although there are some discrepancies between those accounts. It's what they say about the impact that the rebellion had on Nero and those back in Rome that is of interest to our own story. By all accounts, Nero was terrified when he heard about the events unfolding in Britannia, initially thinking to abandon the province when news of the destruction of its Roman towns reached him, and only calming down again once the tide had turned back in Rome's favour. But more interestingly, for us anyway, it's the manner in which the authors of those ancient accounts have Boudica portray Nero that is very revealing, because although they had, in reality, absolutely no idea what that formidable woman would actually have said, the words that they put into her mouth tell us what later Romans themselves felt about the dissolute emperor. So let's take a look at what Cassius Dio had to say. Boudica is described as very tall, with a fierce glance and a harsh voice, a total contrast to descriptions of Nero, with his ungainly stature and whispery voice. Her mass of tawny hair hung to her hips, and she wore a large golden torque around her neck. She would customarily wear a multicoloured tunic, around which a thick mantle was secured with a brooch, says Dio. And again, the subtext is contrasting her very regal bearing and attire with Nero's affectation for dressing up in women's tunics and costumes, such as a lyre player's robe. But it's during the speech by Boudica to her army that Dio really sticks the knife in by having the warrior queen paint a devastatingly emasculating picture of her Roman counterpart, appealing directly to the war goddess of the ancient Britons. Dio has Boudica declaim, "I thank thee, Andraste, and call upon thee as woman speaking to woman, for I rule over no burden-bearing Egyptians as did Nitocris, nor over trafficking Assyrians as did Semiramis, for we have by now gained this much learning from the Romans, much less over the Romans themselves, as did Messalina once, and afterwards Agrippina, and now Nero, who though in name a man, is in fact a woman, as is proved by his singing, lyre playing, and beautification of his person. Wherefore, may this mistress Domitia Nero reign no longer over me or over you men. Let the wench sing and lord it over Romans, for they surely deserve to be the slaves of such a woman after having submitted to her for so long." Now, that translation was taken from the original one by Herbert Baldwin Foster. They are stinging words indeed. It's as if the gender roles have been reversed, with the Iceni queen promoted in almost masculine terms, while Nero is demoted to a vain and weak woman. That whole diatribe levelled at Nero by Cassius Dio through the mouth of Boudica is a direct slandering and mockery of Nero's virtus, his masculinity and military prowess. And Dio would also have been all too aware that Seneca was still Nero's closest advisor at the time of the Boudican revolt. So it's very obvious the later commentators considered that, even by this stage, Seneca had lost all control of his charge. We might also read into this that Seneca himself, with his own lack of military pedigree, was being impugned by extension. And I think we also have to take into account the question of why the Romans felt they could get away with the bullying, money-extorting tactics that they were employing in Britannia at that particular point in time. Now, it's certainly true that there had been no lack of venal Roman governors extorting their provincial charges in other Roman territories over time. But there's an argument here that the state of the Principate in Nero's Rome, its growing licentiousness and lack of morality, led people like Catus Decianus to believe they could behave as badly as they wanted to and get away with it. But was Seneca actually to blame for what happened? Or was his own money lending and questionable debt collecting activity around the time of the revolt tarnished with the same brush as the aggressive repossession and recalling of loans practiced by the incumbent venal and avaricious procurator of Roman Britain, Catus Decianus? There's no real way of knowing. But while it's certainly true that later Roman commentators hostile to Nero's regime would take the opportunity of lumping in his closest advisor Seneca with the other parties responsible for the Boudican rebellion, we must also take into account Seneca's personal circumstances at the time. Having lost the battle to mould Nero into anything even approaching a good ruler, Seneca had to start looking out for himself. Whether he was seeking to consolidate his personal wealth for his own family's ongoing benefit, should he himself fall victim to the emperor's capricious nature, or he was seeking to procure funds for some other personal venture, a tilt at the throne for himself perhaps, there was personal reason enough for him to call in his debts. He was, after all, the author of that be-all and end-all of commentaries on the Roman patronage and benefaction system, De Beneficiis, which we talked about in the last podcast, the timing of which could almost be construed as official notice that Seneca was about to call in favours and loans. In my opinion, then, there were solid grounds for Seneca to enforce repayment of his British loans, although, to be fair, there is not really any evidence that he had any direct involvement with the Iceni tribe. But even so, in the context of a climate of aggrievement about the rapacious way the Romans were behaving in the province in AD 60, Seneca's personal contribution to the sense of national resentment in Britannia could hardly have helped. But back now to what else was going on at Rome itself in the year AD 60. Following the precedent set by Julius Caesar and the Emperor Augustus, who had thrown festivals at 5-yearly intervals to celebrate their own terms in office, Nero decided to inaugurate his own event, known as the Quinquennial Neronia, which involved, among other activities, competitions in music, oratory, poetry, gymnastics, and horse riding. Now, true to form, Nero ensured he would win the lyre-playing crown by creating an environment in which he was the only competitor. In other words, nobody else was stupid enough to go up against the emperor for fear of what might happen to them if they beat him. And this festival, these games, are also notable for the mention in the annals of one Marcus Annaeus Lucanus, known to history as the poet Lucan. Now, this young man, he was only in his early 20s at the time of the Quinquennial Neronia, was actually our Seneca's nephew, the son of his younger brother Mela. Lucan had studied rhetoric at Athens and, in all likelihood, had also been tutored by his uncle, which would imply he'd been introduced into the circles of the imperial court at Rome, where he seems to have become a favourite and friend of Nero. It's reported that it was the emperor's intervention that secured Lucan a quaestorship, that's the lowest rung of the cursus honorum, or the Roman ladder of official office, before the officially legal age of 30. At Nero's festival, Lucan was awarded a prize for extemporising two pieces, the Orpheus and the Laudes Neronis, and that's a sign that the lad had talent. But it would be Lucan's extraordinary epic poem, Pharsalia, the tale of the civil war between Julius Caesar and Pompey, that would cement his place as a literary great. And Lucan was not the only relative of Seneca's to be hanging around Nero's court. We'd also mention Annaeus Serenus, probably a more distant relative to Seneca than the poet Lucan. And he was the dedicatee of Seneca's philosophically purest earlier works, De Constantia Sapientis, De Tranquillitate Animi, and most likely De Autio. If we recall from a previous podcast, Serenus had been instrumental in covering up Nero's affair with the freedwoman, Claudia Actae, and had been appointed to the position of the Praefectus Vigilum, who was responsible for the corps of men that protected the city of Rome against fire. But within the space of 5 years after AD 60, both of these young men, Lucan and Serenus, would meet untimely ends at the hands of an increasingly paranoid and psychotic Nero. But that's material for future podcasts. Back though to Seneca's urgent retrieval of his British investment. Was it simply a matter of retrieving an investment before it became irretrievably lost? Or was there something else going on at this stage around AD 60, which was making Seneca call in all his debts? In the last podcast, we looked at his De Beneficiis, that exhaustive commentary on the complex and hierarchical system of favour exchange, of quid pro quo, of you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. And we asked if that was not in itself a reminder to everyone out there to whom Seneca had given a leg up that payback time was coming. Now, there was no doubt he was coming under pressure from an increasingly erratic Nero. There's also the possibility that Seneca was looking at the rapidly disintegrating reputation of the Julio-Claudian line, as embodied by its current incumbent Nero, and wondering if the time might not be approaching where a regime change could be on the cards. A regime change headed up, perhaps, by Seneca himself. Could that be why he was calling in all his debts in such a hasty fashion? Or was it simply that Seneca had enough sense to realise that his ride on the hog's back was coming to an end? That it was only a matter of time before Nero's capricious moods and malicious intent turned on his own one-time tutor and closest advisor? In Lucan's Pharsalia, the epic poem I mentioned a short while ago, there's a ringingly brilliant couplet in Book 7 on lines 504-5, in which the poet describes the way that the goddess Fortuna, that oldest and most fickle of deities, did not let the fate of the climactic battle of Pharsalus hang long in the balance, before sweeping all away in her ruinous flow. Well, the baleful eye of Fortuna in the form of Nero would eventually fall on the Annaeus family, the Gens Annia, of which Lucan, Serenus, and Seneca himself were all members. The destruction that it would wreak would take longer to make itself manifest than that which swept away Pompey's army at Pharsalus in a single day. It would take another 5 years, in fact, but from AD 60 onwards, Seneca was running very, very scared. Okay, that's it for now. In the next podcast, we'll look at AD 61 and the curious case of the murdered slave owner that resulted in citywide riots, and that will give us the opportunity to examine in more detail the character of our own Lucius Annaeus Seneca. That's as far as the existing evidence will permit us. Okay, I hope to see you there.